Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Appreciate you tuning in today. A federal immigration crackdown drew protests from local officials over the weekend, including Governor Jay Inslee.
Ripping sons from their mothers and young women from their fathers is un-American. And today we are here not just to protect children, but to protect our basic character as Americans.
Local immigrant rights advocates learned last week that about 200 people detained at the U.S.-Mexico border had been sent to California, Oregon, and a federal prison in SeaTac. Some had been separated from their children, who are now in federal custody. Seattle Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal was there and met with many of the detainees. Representative Jayapal, welcome back to KUOW.
Thanks, Bill. Great to be here.
You were able to meet with these detainees for a few hours, some of whom had been separated from their children. What did you hear?
Well, I met with 174 of the 206. The rest of them were men, and I did not meet with the men, though I plan to go back and try to do that as well. The vast majority of them are asylum seekers, and at least 40% of them, I would say, were mothers who had come with their children and had their children forcibly separated from them. They had not had a chance to say goodbye to their children, explain anything about what was happening. The majority of them had no idea where their children were. They had not talked to their children since being in detention. And most of them were, I would say maybe 65% of them had been detained for more than 2 weeks. And a huge number were over a month that had been in detention. So it was absolutely heartbreaking. There is no reason. These are asylum seekers. They were prosecuted in mass courts, so 75 to 100 people at a time in criminal courts along the border. Most of these people came from Texas. They all came from the border, but most of them came from Texas. They were from 16 different countries, which I think people may not know. There was actually a good...
Not even just Central American countries.
No, not just Central American countries. As far away as Eritrea and China, there were a group of seven Chinese women who I was not able to talk to because there was no interpreter. So we'll also go back for that. But it was... You know, I don't even have the words really to describe what I heard. And I've been working on immigrant rights work for 20 years. These are not new stories to me. But these are asylum seekers who talked about the conditions within CBP and Border Patrol and ICE facilities along the border. They talked about places as dog pounds, as ice boxes. The ice boxes are places that are kept so cold, the temperature is kept so cold that you're freezing and you don't have blankets, you don't have mats. Some of them came from across the river. They crossed over the Rio Grande, were wet, and then went straight into this freezing ice box. One woman talked about, several women actually talked about not having access to drinking water. In one case, she said she didn't have access for 5 days. They were held in these facilities where they weren't given clean drinking water. They had a sink, but it was dirty chlorinated water.
Why were they brought to SeaTac? As I said, these are people who were detained at the Mexico border.
Well, the Jeff Sessions and the Trump administration has announced that they're transferring 1,600 people from the border to other facilities to hold them. And the ICE detention facility, which is in Tacoma, as you know, is 95% full. They didn't have space for them. And that's because of the increased mass deportations and enforcement that the Trump administration has been putting forward.
So they're now moving them
into federal prisons. This is a federal Bureau of Prisons facility. And the thing, Bill, that I will say is that it is, because it's a Federal Bureau of Prisons facility, it is government owned and operated, all unionized employees. And so, shockingly, even though it's a prison, these women said it was the first time they had been treated as human beings. So that tells you something about how they were treated before they got here.
What do they know about where their children are?
They know nothing about it. Some
literally have no idea where their kids are.
There were two women who knew that their kids were with family members, but they had not been able to talk to the children. There was a group of women who had just 12 hours before I saw them been visited by ICE and given pieces of paper, just strips of paper, maybe about an inch and a half big, that had their name and the names of their children and then the location of where their children were. But they didn't know where that was. And in one case, a woman said, this is the slip I was given, and these two children are listed, but they're not my children. So I don't know whose children they are, which doesn't give you a whole lot of faith about, you know, how ICE is even keeping track of this information.
The U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions said, quote, if people don't want to be separated from their children, they should not bring them with them. We've got to get this message out. Do you agree with the Trump administration that these separations are discouraging parents from bringing their kids here?
That is the most outrageous statement from our Attorney General that I can imagine. This is asylum seekers. Asylum seekers are allowed to come with their children to the border and ask for asylum. They are supposed to be given a credible fear hearing, and then they are supposed to be released so that that can take its process.
What happens at a credible fear hearing? Does that mean the U.S. government investigates their stories of violence or persecution?
Correct. It's essentially an initial assessment of whether or not they have the right to get asylum. And then there's another program called the Family Case Management Support Program that was a pilot program that was implemented by ICE and then unfortunately stopped by the Trump administration that was really, really effective because what they did is they linked up resources, legal resources and support resources with these individuals. And in some cases, they, after talking to their attorneys, there were even some people that said, I realize I don't have a legitimate claim, so I will go. In other cases where they did have legitimate claims, the attorneys and the resource support people would help them to make sure they come back for the hearings that they need to hear, you know, come back for. And 95, I have the exact statistic somewhere, but I think it's around 95% of all of the people enrolled in that program came back. They were absolutely complying with all of the procedures. And so, you know, this is a cost-effective way for taxpayers to take care of folks, and it makes sure that they get their due process and that we comply with international human rights standards. This is, I want to make it clear to listeners, the right for people to seek asylum is part of our international human rights conventions. What Jeff Sessions is saying is actually illegal because he's talking about using family separation as deterrence. That has been proven by U.S. courts to be illegal. You can't deter people by saying we're going to separate your families. You have to provide certain responses to people who are seeking asylum.
I remember President Obama's administration being criticized for family detention centers. How do you compare those solutions?
Totally different. You know, we had, and I had, a lot of criticisms of the Obama administration and how they enforced immigration law. But I will tell you that there were no mass prosecutions of families with children, no mass prosecutions of people seeking asylum.
Well, what was your criticism then of the Obama administration?
Well, he ramped up interior enforcement programs like 287G programs that were not necessary. He started to do some enforcement around the border that we didn't think was it sort of laid the groundwork in some ways for some of what's happening. But I can tell you, I've never seen anything like that. Like this, this is nowhere close in terms of comparison. That does not mean that if this practice were to stop, that we would be fine. I have introduced a bill called the Dignity for Detained Immigrants Act with Adam Smith that specifically overhauls the detention system as a whole. And I would say that listeners here and across the country should be asking their Congress members to sponsor that bill, because it addresses some of the core deficiencies of an ICE and detention system gone rogue.
Assuming the Trump administration's not going to change its policy, you know, on immigration, its admissions policy, what do you realistically expect them to do differently when parents are detained?
Well, they have to release these parents. I mean, this is our demand, that they release these people who are being held, these asylum seekers who are being held, and that they immediately get reunited with their children.
Release them. So one that's at SeaTac right now, if they're released, what happens to them next?
They would be allowed to go into the community, and they would be able to then process their due process claims. But they should have credible fear hearings, which is what should have happened to start with. Then they should be released, and they should be able to be reunited with their families. There's no reason that they should be separated from their children. And let me tell you, these kids are as young as 1 year old. These moms, I mean, there was not a dry eye in the house. It was heartbreaking. They were describing being there as their children were weeping and calling out for them in another room, and they couldn't go to them. And some of these kids are 1 year, you know, 1 year old, 3 year old, 5 year old, 6, 7 years old. What are we doing to people? And the psychological trauma of these kids and these parents is heartbreaking.
Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal visited with many of these detainees at the federal facility in SeaTac. And what do you expect to happen next?
Well, we're going to have a big action next week with some members of Congress. We will be doing a series of legislative actions as well, letters. We're going to try to have some hearings, even if they have to be shadow hearings, if we can't get official hearings. And we're going to be trying to get our Republican colleagues to speak up, because this is not a Democrat-Republican issue. These are families. And I really think that if we could get a camera in front of these individuals and have them tell their stories to the American people, people would understand that the false stereotypes that the Trump administration is putting out about these being murderers and rapists and people who want to hurt us would be out the window. And I think that the American people would understand that this is the worst tragedy and torture that we are bringing about on people, and we should not let it happen in our name.
Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, thanks for coming back to KUOW.
Thank you, Bill.
The record continues in just a moment. Stay tuned. Thank you for tuning into The Record on KUOW. For years in American pop culture, motherhood has been treated as a gauzy pink enigma. Mothers glowed during pregnancy. They nursed their babies discreetly and in private. Being a mother was seen as a woman's highest calling. The pressure women can feel to be perfect, well, that can start just a little after they learn they're pregnant. Doctors, pregnancy books, the internet, strangers offering advice, not always based in fact. Seattle writer Angela Garbez wondered why it all has to be that way, and the book that emerged from that curiosity is called Like a Mother. And Angela joins us now, along with her mom, Josie, and Angela's very, very small daughter. How old is LaGaia?
She's 3 months old.
3 months old. Welcome, all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. Three generations in the studio.
Three generations with me in the studio. Angela, you are so skeptical of the medical establishment that I was a little surprised to find out that Josie, your mom, is a nurse. So first, Angela, will you tell us what you mean when you say the medical establishment doesn't have all the answers?
Right. Well, I mean, I mean that pretty simply. And I wouldn't say that I'm so skeptical. I think that there's great benefits, which I have talked about in the book,
yes,
to medicine and what they've done to reduce the rates of maternal mortality and infant mortality. But it's really only in the last century that in American society we've medicalized childbirth, which is around the world for centuries it was midwives who guided birth. And those are people who, older women who had lived experience. They didn't have formal training, but they had, you know, undeniable expertise. And so the establishment of the medical establishment really was an active campaign to discredit midwives and to establish obstetrics and gynecology. And so while I think there's many benefits that have come from that, I think there's also great wisdom that can be learned from women and from listening to those stories. And that's what I'm interested in, sort of finding a balance between those two.
Josie, what did you learn about the medical establishment reading your daughter's new book?
Wow. I'm really amazed at all the information my daughter had put out there for everybody to read. Even though I'm a nurse, even in my nursing career, we really knew little. I'm not saying knew little, but there were so many things too that I'm amazed. The information that she had expounded in her book. There are a lot of changes now in the medical profession, in the nursing profession. I don't even know if I can go back because it's high tech. It's really high tech nursing now. It's very different. Very different from where I'm going to be 50 years, celebrating my 50 years in nursing school. In fact, we're going to have our 50th reunion. But a lot of things have changed. I open myself to the new changes, especially with child rearing, helping them with the care of the grandchildren.
What's a change? What's a significant change in child rearing?
Well, we used to put our babies to sleep on their belly.
Yes.
Now I can't do that. we never swaddled. I never experienced swaddling in the Philippines. I had to buy into that.
She called it mummification.
I called it mummification because you see the baby old, can't move, but I found out it was for the babies good, because when they have the startle reflex, they wake up. But being in the swaddle, it makes them just sleep continuously. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the big thing I had to buy into.
Well, how do you know, Angela, when we have so much information available to us? We have doctors, and we have traditions, mm-hmm. and we have assumptions. And how does a modern mother or about-to-be mother sort through all that without feeling all the pressure you describe in this book?
Well, I think that's the thing is we sort through all of that and we feel tremendous pressure at the same time. And so the way we set things up, there's really, you know, there's a right way, there's a wrong way to do things. This is better than that. And so women tend to often feel like they're not doing things right. And so there's this idea, too, of the good mom versus the bad mom, which we joke about. And I think we'd be better off just abandoning that altogether. And
But aren't some practices, to generalize, better than others? I mean, what you go into the amazing quality of breast milk, for mm-hmm. example. So how do you say, you know, in general, breastfeeding is a great idea without a mom or a pregnant woman taking that in as pressure?
Right. So, well, I mean, I'm hoping to say that breast milk, this is where it comes from. To me, that enthusiasm for breastfeeding and breast milk comes from an appreciation of the female body, which I don't think we have enough of in our culture. That's not to say, you know, the truth is, though, that we don't have enough support for women who want to breastfeed. And there are also people who are unable to. So formula, I'm glad that it exists. While breast milk is optimal nutrition for a baby, guess what? In America, your baby's going to be fine if it has formula. But what I'm interested in is, instead of saying one is better than the other, why don't we just make it clear, even if we suddenly reversed all of our policies and supported women completely, not every child is going to be breastfed. You know, in America, 25% of women go back to work after just 2 weeks after giving birth. So why don't we just make sure that both options are accessible to people and that we have the best formula possible?
Josie, you mentioned swaddling and sleeping on the back versus the belly. What are some ways that pregnancy was different for you and your daughter? Not child rearing, but the
pregnancy.
Before that, yeah.
You know, during my time, we look up to our physicians, follow their advice, look up to them. Even in the Philippine culture, doctors are looked upon with respect, you know, because they're the knowledgeable one. Mm-hmm. And I grew up into that concept. I never have a lot of the materials that Angela has now availed herself of. And
yes, hi, Lagaya. Did you? We were talking about that women can feel judged and held to a perfectionist standard. My wife felt that way around it could be breast milk or a glass of wine or raw fish or many practices. Did you have a version of that when you were pregnant? Did you feel these societal pressures, and what were they if you did?
Well, my situation is unusual in the sense that we immigrated here in 1970. My husband came to the United States, and we didn't have any support system. I was not even in my own Filipino community. So I kind of was on my own when we raised our children, and we just went by what we how we were going to raise our children. We didn't go by the book or whatever. We just follow our instinct, providing them with love.
And how was that? Was that easier? Was it harder? Or both?
I think both. Both. Well, it was hard in a sense, especially when I was telling them when I got sick and I had nobody around and I had two boys. I couldn't get up. But you survived that and then start forming your friends afterwards, your root system, you know, they're growing up. But I think,
you know, my mom is an incredibly strong person and she's an incredibly smart person and she was on her own and she had to trust her instincts. And part of what I want to advocate for in the book is that, yes, we have, you know, almost infinite number of ways to get knowledge and an infinite number of opinions. If you look on the internet, you can find whatever answer it is you're looking for. And I want women to feel like they can trust themselves, that, you know, of course they're looking out for the baby. And so that should be a given. You know, we shouldn't assume that people are making selfish choices and, you know, in putting their baby in peril at every turn. Really, everyone's doing the best with what they have. My mom did that, you know, 40 years ago, and women are still doing that. And it's been 40 years, so I feel like women should feel more supported than they did 40 years ago.
You also talk in your book, the book is Like a Mother by Angela Garbez. The subtitle is A Feminist Journey Through the Science and Culture of Pregnancy. And you get into the physicality of pregnancy, Angela, mm-hmm. in a way you say isn't what most women hear about, you know, body parts and fluids and smells, right?
That's Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a very, very transformative and wild physical ride. You grow another person in your body. Your organs have to go somewhere else while that baby grows. Mm-hmm. And getting that baby out means those organs move around, and then they also have to go, hopefully, back into place. But it's not always like that. You know, it's an incredible physical transformation. And, you know, my mom and I both had surgeries to have our children, and that wreaks a lot of havoc on the body.
And Josie, what was that like reading your daughter's book that was so explicit about that physical part of it, that's not in a way that most Americans, at least, are used to reading about?
Well, because of my nursing background, I'm used to the anatomy and physiology, but I'm sure other people are not. But it's still amazing, you know, for me to read it as a review.
Do you have a review of it?
No.
Oh, yes. Let's hear your review.
Well, I had 3 cesarean sections, so I pretty much can identify with what she went through. Mm. But it was not a choice for me, having a C-section for the second and third, my second and my third children. So mm-hmm. it was rough, but... And I come from a culture where pain is, we tolerate a lot of pain. You know, I never had pain medications after my C-section. Oh, but finally, on the third one of the nurses says, why do you want to do that? And you know, a simple aspirin helped me. So I was not afraid to say, take an aspirin. You don't have to suffer.
Angela, you seem like you're learning about some of this for the first time.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad we're all here together talking about this. Thank you for having us. I was on Percocet for weeks after my C-sections, and to think of my mother, I mean, I'm already on record as saying she's incredibly strong, but I didn't realize that she recovered from 2 C-sections without any pain medication. That is, first of all, everything about caring for a newborn is at odds with recovering from surgery, and the idea that you did that without anything is just, you're incredible, Mom.
Can you feel that admiration, Angela, without the stigma and shame? You get into that in your book too, the idea of how you have a child and what kind of medications you're on and whether you're at home or you're in a hospital.
Yeah, I just feel like we tend to view things as, I mean, you can certainly have your personal opinion about what you want for yourself. You should have that, right? And you can have an opinion. But the truth is, you know, we give birth 2 ways now. There's a tremendous pressure. You know, we divide along like medical, quote unquote, I'm using air quotes, medical or natural childbirth, but a baby born from its mother's body is natural, however that happens. And so why don't we just accept that we give birth 2 ways now? One is not better than the other. And again, why don't we just try to provide and make sure that both options are safe and accessible for all women?
Angela, you begin the book on motherhood, on pregnancy, with the story of a miscarriage. And one woman you spoke to about pregnancy loss said women were made for birth and life and death. What does that mean to you? What has that meant to you?
It was, I remember when she said it, Dr. Kristen Swanson, she's the dean of nursing at Seattle University, and it stayed with me, and it was a huge guiding image in what I wrote about miscarriage. But I think what it gets to is that women are incredibly powerful to be able to grow a life inside of you and to be able to give birth, which is no joke. That's a tremendous power. And I wish that we as a culture could see it as that we could talk about it as a tremendously powerful thing, not something that is disempowering or that makes us feel weak or that makes us feel broken afterwards.
Do you think of yourself as, do you need to get Ligaya?
Well, I wanted to see if my mom had something to say, so I
yes.
could go grab her.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, we could do a little shift while you can go around while
I'm
asking your mom.
Yeah, I'm going to come around and get her so my mom can talk.
We're talking about women being made for birth and life and death. And Josie, you worked for years as a hospice nurse. You said that when your own mother was dying, it was hard to set your training aside and just be her daughter. Would you tell us that story?
Well, I have been a hospice nurse for how many years? Maybe 20 years, half my career. But when my mother was dying, she didn't want to die. It was so hard to discuss death with my mom. She was 97 and a half at that time. She wanted to live to be 100. If you had known my mom, she was life. She danced. She learned how to drive at over age 60. She sold insurance policy when she migrated to Canada. She was dancing until the day she had the dialysis. And she didn't want to die. And it was so difficult. I couldn't talk to her about putting a living will or something like that. So what I decided to do was just let her die the way she wants to die. And finally, the day came where she said, I don't want to have any more dialysis. And I said to her, Mom, if you stop your dialysis, you know you're going to die. And she said, I know. So we gave her that dignity. She never had hospice care. But it wasn't very popular in the Philippines at that time, too, hospice care. But she died with dignity. She chose the way she wanted to leave this earth. And we were so glad that we were able to do that for her.
Angela has experiencing pregnancy loss and motherhood and researching this topic and talking with your mother. Has that changed your relationship with your mom, Josie?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
How's that?
Well, my mom, I've felt nothing but unconditional love for my mom, and I'm really lucky in that way. But we're very different people. And, you know, I'm not the daughter that she and my dad expected to have, and I grew up in a totally different culture. And when I got pregnant, I started thinking, well, I mean, I guess to back up, I'd say that like many of us who are fortunate enough to have our moms in our lives, we think of moms as being a really fixed identity. They're the rock, they're the foundation of our families. And it did not occur to me until I myself was pregnant and became a mom that she was someone who changed right along with us, that she went through so many different changes in her life. So I came to her with a new understanding and with wanting to talk to her about all of those things, and also just to realize what she put on the line for us in her life and giving birth to us and all that she did for us. And it's just opened up our relationship, and I feel like we're learning from each other and we depend on each other in ways that we didn't before.
You want the last word, Mom?
The last word? Well, you know, we grew up in a different culture. When we brought our children here, little did we realize it's going to be a whole different culture that my children were going to grow into, up into. But they're all, I mean, I'm not sorry that they didn't, were not raised in the Philippines. I'm glad they were raised here because they have their own characters, their strong opinions, they're independent in their thinking. And that the number one thing that we always stress is family comes first. We have to remain family, no matter where we are.
Angela, do you think Ligaya needs you now?
I mean, she always needs me. She's 3 months old, so
she seems like she has a good sense of when it's time for a conversation to come to a natural conclusion. Ligaya, thanks for hanging in there. Again, Ligaya, the number is 206-543-9595, just for future reference.
She can join Josie, my mom Josie, who's already an evergreen member, AUOW.
Angela Garvez is the author of the book, Like a Mother, A Feminist Journey Through the Science and Culture of Pregnancy. And Angela's here with her daughter and with Angela's mom. Josie, thank you for coming into KUOW and talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
Angela. Thank you for having us.
Bye, Ligaya. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. KUOW Seattle, this is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. It's Monday, which means we've got two panelists in the studio to talk about the stories that moved them this weekend. The biggest of those, the death of chef and author Anthony Bourdain.
In my worldview, food certainly plays a role, hopefully, in bringing some kind of enlightenment and understanding and openness and appreciation of other cultures.
Anthony Bourdain was also a television host at the shows A Cook's Tour, No Reservations, and most recently, Parts Unknown. He was found dead on Friday in France, and the cause of death was suicide. Here with me to remember Anthony Bourdain and his legacy are our panelists. Andrea, will you say your last name for me?
Otanas.
Otanas is a journalist and lecturer in journalism and communications at the University of Washington, former editor at the Seattle Times. Xiaoqing Chao, former food editor at the PI, and author of the cookbook Chinese Soul Food, A Friendly Guide for Homemade Dumplings, Stir Fries, Soups, and More. Welcome back.
Thank you, Bill.
So, Xiaoqing, you have cooked with Anthony Bourdain.
I have.
You posted a photo of you and him on Instagram. What were your experiences with him?
You know, when I was at the PI, he would come through town every year or every other year on tour for one of his books. And so I had plenty of opportunities to interview him. And also on one of those trips, I decided that I would invite him over for dinner because he, you know, had been on the road for such a long time. And anybody who's been on the road knows that a home-cooked meal is something that is kind of a godsend. So I thought, well, I'll do that. Most people would probably be intimidated to cook for somebody like that. But I thought, you know, it's just food. And that's what it's about, is just coming together around the table. And I made pot stickers for him. And subsequently, he invited me on his show, No Reservations, to make pot stickers with him. So that was my little 15 minutes of Tony Bourdain fame.
What do you remember about that dinner?
When we cooked together mm-hmm. on show, it was really fun because he and the crew came over and they took over our house, and I had people sitting on my counter and, you know, cameras all over the place. And Tony, and he's so tall and I'm not, so it was just funny for us to, he was like hunched over my counter as I was trying to demonstrate how to make dumplings. And
in fact, I think we have some audio from that.
Okay, now for the real reason I've come. Xiaoqing's pot stickers. Dinner ready yet?
You know, you have to put in a little elbow grease yourself.
Oh, no. I'm not Bobby Flay. I don't cook on this show.
You're cooking in my house. Don't give me any crap.
Where's that cute Jamie Oliver when you need him? Oh, well.
Don't give me any crap.
Oh, well, you know, I was trying to be a little irreverent because I'm usually a pretty serious person. So I was trying to play along a little bit. But it was really fun to have him and the crew. And he's so gracious, you know, despite all of his brashness out there. He's such a gracious guest.
Anthony Bourdain was not just a chef and food writer. He was a traveler. He told the New York Times last fall how travel affected him.
I loathe, in principle, the idea of adhering to any orthodoxy or strict belief system, because my travels have shown me, as I move from place to place, that what I thought yesterday is, in fact, completely wrong again and again.
Andrea, you were telling us that Anthony Bourdain influenced how your children act when they're traveling?
Absolutely. He is a major teacher to my children. In fact, it was my children who turned me on to Anthony Bourdain. And my daughter took off for Southeast Asia and is a really good cook, in part because of Anthony Bourdain. And, you know, this weekend I was in Florida for a teaching conference. And so I heard about his death on the radio at 7 a.m. right when it happened. NPR broke in. And Anthony Bourdain was so important in my children's life and therefore my life that I texted them right away because I wanted them to hear it from me, right? That's how important he was in our worldview and my children's lives. So, you know, you mentioned, I don't know if you mentioned David Remnick or not, I think, but David Remnick wrote something for, I think it was Eater this weekend, where he talked about how Kitchen Confidential came to be and how he was sort of the connective tissue there. And Remnick said that Anthony Bourdain helped us get to know the other. And I like to think Anthony Bourdain unothered the other, right? He got out of the way and let people tell their stories. He let them be who they were and led us there. So, yeah, he's been huge.
You're nodding your head, Xiaoqing.
Well, because I found out about it on LinkedIn, of all places. It wasn't in my, you know, food feeds. It was I woke up in the morning and I checked. I don't know why I checked LinkedIn that at that point and on that day, but I did, and I saw a mention of it from somebody who is in communication. So it wasn't even somebody in food, and it was on LinkedIn. So Tony transcended everything that was about being a chef and about being a cook, and became very much a part of our broader culture. And that, I think that's what has made it so hard for a lot of people to kind of take in this news.
What did you think of the image he boosted? I don't know if he created this, but the hard living chef, you know, the drug use was part of it. And what did you think of that image of the culinary world?
Well, it's a reality still. He gave voice to it. And I think over the years, as he matured as a person and as somebody who had a global platform, he understood that maybe, you know, he glorified it in some sense with that first book, and he's toned it down. He had toned it down a bit. I don't know that he regretted that, because he was telling his truth and telling the truth of a lot of people who work in the industry. But a lot of the issues that he experienced still exist, and that hasn't necessarily quieted down. I think we are collectively more aware of it and are talking about how we can address some of those the drugs and that harsh life. And, you know, a lot more chefs now are flaming out and looking for balance, whatever that means. So I think we're definitely more aware of it now, but he did, he gave voice to that lifestyle in a way.
You, both of you are journalists. What did you think of how the media has covered the suicides of Anthony Bourdain, Kate Spade, right around the same time?
You know, I've been paying attention to that, because we do like to teach about that in our program for sure, hewing closely to the advice that organizations like SAVE and Forefront here on the UW campus talk about, trying to educate about mental health and suicide prevention. And what I'm noticing, and this is fabulous, is that fewer and fewer people are using the word committed when talking about suicide. That is becoming, I think, ingrained, which is useful. I see it. I found it a bit this weekend. I also have to say that I do know that out there, there are details, and I don't know if they're true or not, because I haven't read them. I have purposely avoided them, about the manner of death. And I think that's one of those things that we need to teach journalists, that is, you know, unless there is some compelling news reason that is the story, that, you know, that doesn't need to be in the stories because of contagion concerns. So I would say, by and large, what I took in over the weekend, and it was all over the place, from blogs to New York Times to, you know, mainstream media, that I've seen mostly respectful coverage.
We just have time to talk about one more story from this weekend. I want to give a note to our listeners that, you know, if you are very, very troubled, if you think about taking your own life, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That phone number is 1-800-273-TALK. So 1-800-273-8255. A lot of students graduated this weekend or are about to graduate, which sometimes is a reminder of classmates who didn't make it that far. And Marysville-Pilchuck High School is going to have empty seats at this week's graduation ceremony after the years after the shooting there. Franklin High School students protesting Friday over a fatal shooting of a student in Martha Washington Park. And Andrea, what struck you about those events?
You know, I was thankful for the Marysville-Pilchuck High School story. Those students who were in that story were freshmen when that terrible thing happened in 2014, and I connected to, of course, what the students who were the survivors of the shooting at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, what they're doing, how they're hitting the road now that they've graduated, to get students organized and get them registered to vote. So, two things. A, I choose to see hope in these stories, to see that what these students are doing who went through that. B, well, that this is three things, the voting, and then also that protest that happened, or awareness that happened down in Franklin High School last week, after that terrible shooting of the young man in the park. And so I am just seeing some positivity come out of this terrible situation that our children are going through, the anxiety that they're having. And so I just think it's important to pull all that together so that we do not start to normalize those shootings, and realize that we all have a role in reaching out to the people who are nearest to us to help them through this.
Xiaoqing, how are you talking to your kids about this?
Well, both my kids, I have a third grader and a sixth grader, and it's very real to them because they have to do these drills, emergency drills, and that's not something they should have to think about. Maybe a fire drill, but not this kind of thing where they have to go on a lockdown. Or my daughter, who's in middle school, you know, when all the kids walked out, they walked out. Mm-hmm. Like, why is an 11-year-old thinking about walking out of school to protest guns? So it's, for us, it's a visceral subject that we have to talk about. And I kind of just go by what my kids' awareness level is. I don't want to just pound them with too much information because they have to be ready to receive it. So I listen very carefully for what my kids are talking about and then address it at that level. But again, these are things that I now have to think about too. And that's you know, on top of all the regular puberty stuff and social media stuff and mean girl stuff. And then now there's all of this. So our jobs as parents, as citizens, is that much more difficult.
Well, thank you both for helping us reflect on the weekend we just went through, and both of these issues, of course, continuing out into the future, right? Andrea Otanez is a journalist, lecturer in journalism and communications, University of Washington, and the former editor of the Seattle Times. And Xiaoqing Chow is food editor at the Seattle PI, and she's written the cookbook, Chinese Soul Food, A Friendly Guide for Homemade Dumplings, Stir-Fries, Soups, and More. And it's been great to talk with both of you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
And thank you for tuning into The Record on KUOW Seattle.